This podcast is dedicated to the memory of Professor Donal O'Donoghue, Chair of the International Society of Nephrology's Advocacy Working Group at the time of recording, who sadly passed away shortly afterwards. Donal was a wonderful and passionate advocate for advancing global kidney care and leaves behind a large number of bereaved colleagues, friends, and grateful patients. The ISN mourns his loss and offers its sincerest condolences to his family, friends, and colleagues. May he rest in peace. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Paul Laffin, Advocacy Director at the International Society of Nephrology, or ISN for short, and you're listening to our podcast, A Beginner's Guide to Kidney Health. Today, I'm here with Professors Donal O'Donoghue and Ifeoma Ulasi from the ISN's Advocacy Working Group to talk about this important topic. And I should probably just apologise to both of them for having butchered the pronunciation of their names. So, Professor O'Donoghue and Professor Ulasi, if you wouldn't mind just telling us a little bit about yourself and your professional background to start this off.
I'm Ulasi, a professor of medicine at the College of Medicine, University of Nigeria, and I'm affiliated to two hospitals, the University of Nigeria Teaching Hospital and the Federal Teaching Hospital, Abakaliki. Into clinical practice, teaching, research.
Donal O'Donoghue, or O'Donoghue, and I'm a kidney doctor in Manchester, England, and Professor of Kidney Medicine, University of Manchester. I'm also the Registrar of the Royal College of Physicians. I'm delighted to be here as well. Kidney disease is silent but deadly in a way, and I think the more that we all understand how we can keep kidneys healthy, the better for all of us. There's a big preventative dividend to be had. So looking forward to the conversations.
Good place to start is with the basics. Can you tell me and our listeners a little bit about what kidneys do and why they're so important?
First, filter waste. And as they filter the waste, they pass through the ureters and enter the bladder, through which we pass it out. A bean shape, and it is placed, it's located behind the abdominal cavity, protected by the muscles behind and the kind of behind the intestines. So it's well protected behind the abdominal cavity. Like it's about the size of the fist, of your fist, like so. So the kidney, of course, is involved in a lot of functions in the body. Being such a small organ, and it has about a quarter of our blood flows through it per minute, showing you how important such a small organ, having a quarter of your blood flowing through it, shows the function it is helping us to perform. One of the functions is helping us to remove waste products from our body. All what we eat, all the drinks we take, all the medications we take, or things we come in contact through our skin, it helps us remove those waste products, especially after they've been kind of treated somewhat or processed by the liver. We then excrete them through the kidney. They also ensure that our body fluid is at the right amount, that we don't have too much and that we don't have too little. When we have too little, it kind of conserves urine so that you're not making so much urine. So at times, you'll find out when you haven't taken a lot of water or when the weather is dry, you're not passing so much urine. It's because the kidney is doing its function. It also has hormones, or what we call some substances that it emits that perform some duties in the body, like it emit some substances that help us make blood. And we all know how important our blood is.
So its main job is to filter and then to reabsorb what we need. And the filtration surface area, this within that kidney, that the size of your fists, the filtration surface area is the size of a football field, of a regular professional football field. It's enormous surface area there. And mainly the job of the kidney, you know, isn't to produce urine, isn't to make urine. The job of the kidney is to do all those things which essentially controls the internal environment so cells can work normally, all the other cells in the body. So it's very, very much a vital organ of the body. You can get by with one, but kidneys are a vital organ.
Clearly not something that we want to stop working. They do, though, unfortunately. So what kind of diseases can people contract?
So the kidney is essentially a vascular organ. So the surface area that I talked about, that's really glorified blood vessels. So all the things that damage blood vessels, from raised blood pressure, diabetes, atheromavascular disease, all of those diseases can affect the kidney in the same way that they affect the heart and affect other blood vessels. And then there are a range of other what we call primary kidney diseases, diseases that just affect the kidney, where there's inflammatory diseases of the kidney, maybe driven by autoimmunity, our own body attacking the kidney, or maybe triggered by infection. And then there's the cystic disease of the kidney that can damage it, or back pressure from the bladder. So if the bladder's, you know, got an obstruction, or there's a congenital abnormality of the apparatus, then, you know, it can be damaged in that way. And the kidney function falls if the pump for the kidneys isn't working well. So if the heart's not working well, kidney function falls. So there's a whole range of things that can impact on kidneys. And that's some of them. I'm sure Fiona will pick out the ones.
I would like to also add that the kidney also is affected by what we inherit from our parents, or you can have genetic diseases as well. But the inheritance is important in that it predisposes you, because you've inherited a particular gene that predisposes you to kidney disease. Any of these little things, or any of them, when you have them, you now begin to have kidney disease. So if you may have hypertension and somebody else has hypertension, because the person does not have that hereditary bit, that the genes are right, they don't have kidney disease because of that.
One of the illnesses that I've not personally, my wife has had experience of, is kidney stones. And that's one of the, I think, perhaps the most common, the better known, if less serious diseases. How do they come about?
Okay, like I explained, kidney stones, some of them are hereditary. So you have the hereditary diseases that predispose you to forming kidney stones. So when you don't, like, okay, let me give an analogy. When you, in the sink in your kitchen, when you wash your dishes in the sink and you don't flush the sink very well, what happens? You have clumps and of debris in it. And if you don't have enough water, it cakes up and becomes a stone. So that's what happens in the kidney. So oftentimes we tell people who are predisposed to forming stones to take a whole lot of water so that you can flush your tubules, flush your kidney, that you don't have such substances accumulating. So both hereditary and environmental, by not taking enough water.
We've covered actually some of the aspects of the next point that I was going to ask you about. If you were there, you talked about genetic factors in predisposing some individuals towards having the various forms of kidney disease. Beyond genetics, I'm going to imagine that there are many, many different factors which can cause the different types of kidney disease. Could you please describe some of those?
Right. A lot of the systemic diseases like hypertension, diabetes, they are the main causes of kidney disease. But indeed, diabetes is the main cause of kidney disease. But we find out that from the lower and middle income countries, the low resource settings, inflammation of the kidneys come to play. And you know how inflammation of the kidneys arise, like I was explaining earlier. When you have infections, your body tries to fight the infection because you have defense mechanisms inbuilt in your body that fight the infections. When they do that fight, they form debris with the organisms they fight, and those debris deposit in the kidney, which is where they should be removed, and then they cause problems, they cause inflammation of that kidney. That is the main cause of, or one of the main causes of kidney disease in low resource settings. And that's what we call glomerulonephritis. I know many people will not understand it. That's why I said inflammation of the kidney. Then we also have hypertension, which is very common in low resource settings too. Hypertension is a key cause of kidney disease, because what it does is that it raises the blood pressure, and the blood, like we heard Donald say, the kidney is basically made of vessels, blood vessels all over. And when you have blood vessels, the pressure in the blood vessels so high, they damage the kidney. There are also drugs that can damage the kidney. A lot of drugs damage the kidney because they are excreted through the kidney. We also have things like some lifestyle things we do, like alcohol. Alcohol has effect on the kidney, even though its effect may not be direct, but it causes, when you take alcohol, you notice that you pass a lot of urine. And as you're passing a lot of urine, you're kind of drying out or dehydrating your cells, and that will help, will make the kidneys not perform their function very well, and is a problem. Alcohol also affects the liver, causes chronic liver disease, and all our organs are somehow related. Chronic liver disease will affect the kidneys, and you have a problem with your kidneys. Outside, we call autoimmune diseases, where the body is not recognizing its body cells anymore. These autoimmune diseases also invariably affect the kidneys. Lupus is one of the diseases that affects the kidney. I want to particularly mention things that cause kidney disease in my area, like malaria. Malaria is a common cause of kidney disease in my area. Malaria is very prevalent. Also, some other parasitic infections like schistosomiasis. There's a whole lot that can predispose people in this area to kidney disease. And I think that's what contributes to why we have a lot of kidney disease. I would also like to mention the fact that the dry weather we have, or the hot weather we have here, and most of our people living in the rural areas are farmers. So when they farm and they don't take enough water, they are dehydrated, and that is a no-no for the kidney. So we tend to have a lot of kidney disease that you cannot explain by being caused by diabetes, or being caused by high blood pressure, or being caused by inflammation. These are the group of diseases we call the chronic kidney disease of a certain origin.
It's clear that there are lots and lots of things that cause kidney disease. I often say to patients when I meet them first, if it's not clear what it is, that there are 101 causes, and we need to systematically look at what might be causing that in the individual case. In practice, though, I think it does depend where in the world you're working or where people are living, what the spectrum of kidney disease is. In high income countries, it is in adults, and certainly senior adults where kidney disease is very, very common. It's often related to vascular disease. So, raised blood pressure, hyperlipidemia, smoking as well. So that those three things, diabetes, heart disease and kidney disease are not a great combination for people to have, because obviously it affects a lot, but many parts of the body, including the kidney. And about, I think maybe the take-home message or messages that I would say in terms of protecting your kidneys would be think about your heart, all the things that we kind of know we need to do for the heart, we need to do for the kidney. If you're in a hot country, so not Manchester, England, but if you're in a hot country, then do stay well hydrated. And then in terms of medicines, that you may be given or buy over the counter, just be asking, you know, could these affect the kidney? You know, there are non-steroidals, Brufen, ibuprofen, things like that, that, you know, are great if you've got a bad back or a sore foot. Those drugs can be bad for the kidneys, particularly if you take them for a protracted period.
Thanks, both. Again, I was aware probably of about a third of those causes. Again, quite shocking to note what actually... I'm making a connection there. As I say, I'm hearing that different illnesses can lead to kidney disease. So I'm making the connection to myself. Well, if that's the case, what can kidney disease itself lead to? Is there a connection between kidney disease and heart problems, for example, or other diseases?
Yeah. So vascular disease causes, you know, kidney damage because the kidney is a vascular organ, and kidney disease, whether it's by kidney stones or, you know, an autoimmune disease, you know, once the kidney's damaged, that causes blood pressure to be raised and damages the vessels and causes, you know, vascular disease, you know, which could lead to stroke and other vascular problems. You know, that is a two-way process and then an amplifying process. So the kidney gets damaged, that damages the blood vessels. The blood vessels get damaged, that damages the kidney. So it can be an amplification loop, which is scary. But I think the good thing is that you can address that loop by, you know, getting the cholesterol down, getting the blood pressure down, controlling diabetes, stopping smoking. Smoking, you know, is really bad for lots of things, but it's very bad for the blood vessels, and therefore very bad for the kidney. And if you have a little bit of kidney disease, which we'll probably come to, what does that mean? But if you have a little bit of kidney disease, then really, you know, you'll benefit enormously by not smoking and looking after your heart, because the kidney is a vascular organ.
Just to pick up on a couple of points there, if I can, again, going back to my own personal experiences, when my wife had her kidney stones, it was during her pregnancies, and I can remember being told there's a connection, or at least our doctors told us that there's a connection between kidney health and pregnancies. Could you explain that to me a little bit more, please?
All right. When a lady is pregnant, and as the pregnant uterus gets bigger, it applies pressure on the ureters to start with, so that the urine flow is sluggish. So you just like what I explained about the sink in the kitchen. When it's sluggish, then you're likely to form stones. And also in pregnancy, the blood flow through the whole body is so much, and so it is for the kidney as well. So you have very high blood flow passing through the kidneys and all that. So these are some ways they can have problems. And also some of them have what we call hypertension in pregnancy. That's what it's called now. And it's said to be caused by the baby in the uterus producing some toxins kind of in the woman's body. And those toxins will cause very raised blood pressure, which would affect the kidney. I've had to severally manage ladies who have toxemia, eclampsia or toxemia in pregnancy or pre-eclampsia in pregnancy, where the blood pressure went so high and then we had to intervene. In fact, in this particular lady, we had to dialyze because she ended up having acute kidney injury from the blood pressure that went so high and kidney disease. The other thing is that if you have kidney disease ab initio before you are pregnant, it worsens your kidney function. So you may end up after the pregnancy worsening your kidney disease, or you may even end up in kidney failure. So women that are pregnant or have kidney disease that want to get pregnant have to have very, very particular special attention by the nephrologist as well as the gynecologist that take care of them. So that is the link.
You know, most ladies with kidney disease, can carry a successful pregnancy to term. So many of our kidney transplant recipients, go on to become pregnant, just the ladies, and have successful pregnancies. But the risk is if there isn't close observation, then blood pressure can occur and then take off. And then it can be quite a very scary, really, for everyone concerned.
It's much wider spectrum of, I would say, causes of kidney disease than I had imagined. Now, I'm not going to suffer acute kidney injury due to being pregnant. What would I look out for myself to know that if I'm at risk of perhaps having kidney failure of some form or another?
So one of the problems that we have is that kidney disease is silent usually. So until you've lost a lot of kidney function, you know, you wouldn't know it. The flip side of that is that you don't need to have perfect kidney function to be perfectly well. So, you know, the fantastic thing about that is that, you know, you can donate a kidney to your sister, to your wife, to your, you know, to your daughter. You know, you can be perfectly fine just with one kidney. But you know, you wouldn't have any symptoms from kidney disease until you'd lost more than the function of one kidney. So you'd be getting down to fairly low levels, and you know, people might argue about what the level would be, but I think you know probably below 40%. So you've lost 6/10 of kidney function, and in many patients probably it would be closer to 30%, and the first symptoms would be fairly non-specific. You might not be able to, you know, complete your 10K run as quickly as you did before. You'd be a little below par, but you wouldn't have many symptoms. You pass urine at night, so you have to get up and pass urine at night because the kidney doesn't concentrate as well if it's not normal. And at night, normally, you know, we don't have to get up at night to pass urine unless we've, you know, drunk a lot of fluids in the evening before. And in the morning, you know, we'll know that our urine is darker because it's more concentrated. So that the body, you know, tells the kidney, the hormones from the pituitary tell the kidney, you know, to concentrate the urine so that we don't disturb sleep. But if the kidneys are damaged, and they lose that concentrating ability. So actually passing a little bit more urine at night is an early-ish symptom. And then the other symptoms are really pretty advanced, like related to becoming anemic. So exercise tolerance goes down, you know, getting fatigued, maybe getting breathless. And beyond that, then you're in quite advanced kidney disease. So with advanced kidney disease, you know, lots of stuff can go wrong, from, you know, confusion to neuropathy where nerve problems in your feet and things like that. That's pretty unusual these days, because people will, in a high-income country anyway, people will present once they're feeling breathless and unwell. But at that stage, they might be down to, you know, 25% of their kidney function. So that's a sort of a problem. But if you step back from it, well, most of those people who develop advanced kidney disease like that have got a disease process which is, you know, causing the kidney to become damaged. So they may have diabetes, which should have been diagnosed, or hypertension, you know, which is, you know, should be a routine check, or they may have had protein in the urine indicating a kidney disease. So when that had been checked, so for most people, certainly in a high income country like the UK, it's a sort of tragedy when people present with advanced kidney disease, because it's nearly always the case that you can look back and see the missed opportunities to identify the kidney disease. And if you identify it early, there are things that can be done to slow down the progress, or even to prevent, and in some cases even, you know, return the kidney back to normal. So I think the identifying kidney disease early before it's symptomatic is really, really important. And it's important that you do have your blood checked and your urine dipped and your blood pressure checked on an annual basis, usually.
Just having come back from a very substandard 10K run, tomorrow, if I wanted to go to a doctor and ask him for a kidney test, he would test my urine. Don't know. It would be as simple as that. Would I have the results that day?
Well, you'd have a blood test and, you know, we call it a urine electrolytes, but basically, you know, there's a standard test when you check a sodium and potassium. You would check something called creatinine, and that can then be used to work out what percentage kidney function or what how good your filtration is, and then dipstick the urine or send it to the lab. Have you got any protein or blood in the urine? And with those two simple and very, very cheap tests, you'll know, do you have kidney disease or not? And then if you measure the blood pressure as well, which costs nothing, then you'll know whether or not, you know, you need some treatment for the blood pressure, which might be an issue. So I think those three things are blood pressure, the simple blood test for kidney function and the simple dipstick of the urine, you know a massive amount. And from there, you know, decisions can be taken.
Time frames. So, for example, if I presented myself at the, or anybody presented themselves at the doctors, did the blood, the three tests that you just described, how quickly can the results be presented?
Well, the blood pressure straight away. Yeah. The urine, it's dipped then straight away, and the blood test is a routine test. So I think, you know, the laboratory has it very, very quickly. So in England, you know, I'd have that result in an hour or two in the hospital and with a general practitioner the next day. So there are point of care tests. It can be done, you know, immediately. For people, usually the reagents might be a bit more expensive, and maybe the quality might not be perfect, but it's pretty good. So these are routine tests now in any clinical laboratory and really of high quality. So it's unusual that we get results that are false. Mm.
And how worried should a person be if the results come back saying that they have a form of kidney disease? I mean, I understand that most forms of the kidney disease are treatable. Can you tell us a bit more about the types of treatments that are out there, up to, as I say, from the basic stuff up to and including transplantation?
Well, I think, it depends very much on, what will happen with that kidney disease. And so for the vast majority of people, we can together control the blood pressure and avoid the medicines that, you know, otherwise they might take for their bad back or an antibiotic for a chest infection or something. They can be avoided, have some kidney abnormal, represent kidney disease, but they don't have advanced kidney disease. So if their percentage kidney function, is up 45 or 50% or 60% of normal, the patient would be well, the person would be well. And often we can manage that disease such that it's never a problem for the individual. And if it's going to be a problem, we can usually delay that by years or even decades. Sort of magic treatments for kidney disease. Most of the things that we can do that make a really big difference are actually back to this issue that the kidney's a vascular organ. So blood pressure control, smoking, all the things for that, all the things to protect our vascular tree, avoiding poisoning the kidney with the medicines that we might otherwise prescribe. So it's the early identification that allows us to manage those kinds of diseases. And then there are diseases that, we effectively don't have treatments for the disease. So polycystic kidney disease, probably affects something like 1 in 1,000 people. It's a It's a relatively common cause of advanced kidney disease. It runs in families. So, you know, we should be able to identify it early. And of course, we can measure and manage blood pressure. But the cysts themselves continue to grow and the kidney continues to get damaged. So we can keep the person well, but we can't prevent the kidney becoming damaged over the decades. But in those instances, we can manage the complications of kidney disease. The best option is to have your own kidneys. Usually the second best option is to have a kidney transplant before you need to start dialysis. So when I was a young doctor, it was dialysis and transplantation. It's dialysis and then think about transplantation. These days, it's get people early, prevent. If you can't prevent, then get a transplant before the need for dialysis, which you've got a live donor, you've got a brother, a sister, mother, father, a pal who wants to give the kidney, and then a live donor transplant, a kidney function at maybe 10 or 15%, is a really good option. And then not a bad option, but not quite as good an option, would be a form of dialysis. And there are several forms of dialysis. And that can either be a bridge to transplantation, or if there are reasons you can't be transplanted, then that can be, a therapy that people can be pretty well on for a protracted period of time. But not everybody is pretty well on as good as prevention. But dialysis and transplantation, were wonders of the 20th century. They are fabulous treatments. But as I say, prevention's better than, they're not a cure.
I have a rough idea of what dialysis is. If you were speaking to somebody who's never heard the term before, how would you describe it?
Dialysis, there are two forms of dialysis, but the essence of dialysis is to remove the waste from your blood through these processes. There are two forms. We can remove the waste by using the hemodialysis, that we do it through a machine that we pump your blood through, and it goes through a filter. The filters are working like the filters in your kidney, and the filters now extract the waste products and modifies your blood a wee bit, corrects some of the substances like your sodium, your potassium, and then the blood is passed back into you. So essentially what he's trying to do is to remove the waste products, remove excess fluid you may have, depending on the setting we put on the machine. That is hemodialysis. And there are various forms of hemodialysis, the intermittent one or the night dialysis and all that. Then the second one is where we use your peritoneum. Peritoneum is the lining of the intestine, which has a lot of blood vessels in it. So we use it as the membrane, and then we kind of send fluid into your abdominal cavity. Your peritoneum filters the blood. Those tiny, tiny blood vessels will filter the substances out into the fluid in the abdominal cavity. And after like maybe how many hours, 12, 2, 4 hours, the fluid is in your tummy, we remove it. That way we remove the waste. That is the two different types of dialysis. And of course, transplant, where you have to have a kidney from somebody else transplanted into you. When that is done, because the kidney is foreign to you, we have to maintain that kidney in your system because it doesn't belong to you. Your body will try to reject it because that's how we are made, and that's how we take care of ourselves, defense. So the body will try to reject it, and that's why we give you loads of drugs to suppress your immunity, to kind of stop it from rejecting that kidney. And in time, we kind of reduce those drugs that you use. All in all, having a transplant, I think it's the best and is the most cost effective, because if you have a good transplant, the patient is having everything from all the functions we reeled out earlier, helping you to make blood, helping you to produce the substance that will help you make bone, removing your waste products, making sure that the fluid you have in your body is well stabilized. Unlike dialysis, dialysis will only do the exchange of removing the wastes. It's not helping you with making blood. It's not helping you with the vitamin, making sure you have enough substances that will handle your bone. So that is why transplant is the preferred treatment in almost every condition that where somebody has end-stage kidney disease, even in children, in adults, in HIV patients who have end-stage kidney disease. Transplant is the preferred mode of treatment.
The business of the day, we talked there quite a lot about, not we, you both talked about transplantation. And Donald, you talked about the benefits or the preference of getting a transplant from a close relative. I'm assuming where that's not possible, other options are feasible. Could you tell us a bit about those options, please?
Well, just start with those with live donation first. So when live donation started initially, I mean, it probably was, you know, an identical twin got a kidney from his brother, and because it was identical, the body didn't attack it, didn't reject it, and that was a great transplant. But most of us don't have an identical twin, so that's not very common. But family members, yes. A brother or a sister or a father or mother, you know, would share some of their DNA, some of their tissue type, we call it, with the patient, and therefore they'd be a good match. What we found over time is that with live donation, the matching is actually less important than with deceased donation that I'll speak about in a second. So for live donation, you know, the guy that you play football with or run with, my daughter's friend, could give her a kidney, or your friend could give you a kidney. And if it's a live kidney, then actually, you know, we can manage that very well in most instances, if it's blood group compatible. If it's blood group compatible, then the tissue typing and the risk of rejection can be managed much more easily than we initially thought. So it doesn't need to be a relative to donate a live kidney to you. The person's just got to have two good kidneys and want to donate them. So the other form of kidney transplantation is to get a kidney from somebody who's died, unfortunately. So somebody had a road traffic accident and a head injury, often it's a head injury, or somebody who's had a catastrophic stroke. One of my colleagues' 16-year-old son got a head injury and unfortunately died. It was tragic. A child is a horrible and terrible thing. But the importance to his father and to the family of donating was huge. So from that horrible tragedy, you know, came out something really fantastic for the families of the people who got those organs. So many families are happy to donate as well. That used to be the predominant way that kidneys were available in the United Kingdom. Now we have as many people coming forward as live donors as we have deceased donors, people who are brain dead, who are going to die or have already died. So obviously the live donors give one kidney and the deceased donors usually give two kidneys. So a third of all our kidney transplants now are live donor. But, you know, you can give a kidney and be fine.
I was going to make one point. There's a Belfast, there's a BBC Northern Ireland journalist who is going to help us do some promotion with World Kidney Day. And he is the recipient of an anonymous live donor. And one of his big pushes, as you can imagine, is to encourage live donors, because as you just described, it's an absolutely wonderful gift. And as I say, this is something that we'll be pushing on WKD 2021. But you make a very interesting point there, Donal, about some of the more nefarious aspects of transplantation. The term organ trafficking, unfortunately, comes to mind. Now, we know that it does happen. Can you tell us a little bit about that from the professional side of things?
So I think first I'd sort of say hats off to the Belfast and the Northern Ireland Kidney Transplant Service. I think it's top of the league, Champions League, for kidney transplantation. Fantastic work, really spearheaded by one remarkable female nephrologist, Aislinn Courtney. Fantastic work. Norway used to be top of the league, but Belfast is really the place to go to see how it's done. And it's attention to detail and working with the community. And as you say, encouraging people to, give a kidney. You only need one. And of course, both need to be in good shape. But really, there's no reason why, people shouldn't give a kidney altruistically. Although that's not the norm, because, we've usually got brothers or sisters or parents' kidneys. But I have the experience of people coming back having bought a kidney and having had a kidney transplantation in less than ideal circumstances. This is an illegal practice. This is my experience with purchasing kidneys is very limited, but I do have a number of patients who've gone abroad and bought a kidney and had their transplant abroad. Uniformly, they have done badly. The kidney's not been well matched. The immunosuppression has not been well tailored to the individual. Often the individual has been given the gift of hepatitis B as well as the gift of the kidney, because the person that it was purchased off had hepatitis B. We know of some sort of scandals where criminals might be executed and kidneys provided, for this illegal trade. So one, it doesn't work. And two, it's illegal and unethical. And three, there are actually a lot of kidneys around in the world that are decent enough to be transplanted. So, of course, most of us got two and could give one. But also there are plenty of people, unfortunately, who get serious head injuries and other problems that can be kidney donors and want to be kidney donors. So it's an unnecessary trade, but very much I think it is completely unethical, and the International Society of Nephrology is adamant that this is an infringement of human rights, and we're signatories to the Istanbul Declaration there with the transplant community, because it's just plain wrong.
Thank you both. Let's talk figures for a second. I know that over 800 million people globally are currently living with some form of kidney disease. And indeed, the prevalence is over 10% in men and approaching 12% in women. Now, you both mentioned previously that there are different challenges facing patients and the provision of healthcare in lower and middle income countries against the challenges facing patients and healthcare provision in higher income countries. I think, Donal, if we could start with yourself, if you could tell us about some of the challenges facing those challenges in the higher income countries, please.
So I think it's, most higher income countries have universal access to healthcare. So universal access to healthcare is probably the cornerstone of any kind of preventative treatment system. So in the UK, there is universal access within the NHS, but in most countries in Europe, all countries in Europe probably, there is universal access, and sometimes it's insurance-based. It doesn't matter how it's organised. You know, they're all good universal access. And the key issue then is identifying kidney disease early so we can prevent it and slow it down. And so it's those programs to make sure that anyone with diabetes, you know, they do have their urine dipped for protein every year and their blood test done. And we have a difficulty, I think, in explaining to our public what the kidneys do and why it's so important, and that kidney disease is silent. The things we've been talking about earlier, kidney disease is silent. So you're not going to have a pain in your kidney to say, I need to go and get checked. So I think it's having a public facing campaign that is about maintaining kidney health. And that may well be, you know, with diabetes, preventing diabetes, preventing obesity, with hypertension, identifying hypertension effects, you know, is it 15 or 18, 20% of the population, depending where you live. These are common conditions that predispose to kidney disease. And I think it's important that they're given the same priority, because we can slow down kidney disease. And then the next difficulty probably is the cost of management of kidney disease, even in high-income countries. Dialysis is quite expensive. I mean, it's out of the range of people paying from their own pocket, from income or from, you know, savings. It's too expensive for that. It needs universal coverage, you know, for everyone apart from the very, very rich. So back to that universal coverage. And then establishing programs that provide that dialysis, but now focus more and more on transplantation. So in the UK, I'd say early detection, slowing it down, transplant first, and then dialysis options.
Thank you very much for that. Donald, just hypothetically, if you had a magic wand and you were able to convince the British or indeed any of the high-income country governments to implement a policy to tackle kidney disease, what would that be?
So it's about early detection, and early detection is about, you know, the public knowing that the kidneys are important. So it would be about that public-facing education, and then the ability to ease our poorer populations. Populations where we've got higher rates of vascular disease, all of these conditions and circumstances, you know, track together, and poverty in whatever country we're in, poverty is a major association of kidney disease. It's also a major association of lung disease and of liver disease and very. So I think, you know, there's more than just universal access. There's actually that it is accessible for everybody, and not just for people, you know, that have benefited from the education and support and the middle classes. Of course, middle class people and higher class people, if we use those terms, do need access. But kidney disease, like all diseases, is more common in people who are more disadvantaged. So that if you had a focus on inequalities, maybe that would be the overarching public health goal. If we can reduce inequalities, then we will, by our very processes, reduce kidney disease and heart disease and the other diseases. But kidney disease is growing at an incredibly fast rate. Heart disease is falling, stroke is falling, cancers are leveling off, and kidney disease year on year continues to grow. And we know that it will reach a level which will be, you know, pretty problematic for all of us unless we tackle this by early identification and research to understand better how we might protect the kidney.
Thank you very much. Now, if I can ask you, how does that compare with the situation in lower and middle income countries?
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Donald has said a lot of things, and towards the end of his talk, he mentioned about poverty and kidney disease. And you know that in LMICs, we have pervading poverty. So you perfectly understand that the demographics of kidney disease in LMICs is a bit different. One, people are very poor. Two, it affects the young, not like the 80-year-olds. It's more like the 30, 40, 50-year-olds. People at the productive phase of their lives. So you can imagine the effect of such on the economy of any country. As regards the way to tackle it, I have like Tony Blair when he was talking about, was it education? Prevention. I say it three times, prevention, because that is where to anchor it. Because if we prevent it, which we can easily do with simple things, we can actually prevent kidney disease. If we prevent it, then we won't be here talking about, it will only be a few people having transplant or dialysis and stuff like that. Regarding what our government is doing, of course, most of the governments are not very up and doing, but some of them are signing on to the universal health coverage and the essential medicines and all that. We're hoping, like in my country, if you have kidney disease, you pay out of pocket. And that is what is happening in many of the LMICs. Only a few, like South Africa, they have their restricted number that they take care of. And I think Kenya gives the patients some part of the money. And then Ethiopia, I think, takes care of either the transplant or whatever. And then after that, you take care of the drugs. But taking care of the transplant is just one quarter of it, because the drugs that the medications you take after is key. If you don't take those immunosuppressants, you may as well have not done the transplant, because obviously you will lose it. So in summary, yes, prevention. After prevention, early detection, that is secondary prevention, and of course, slowing down the disease. Yes, thank God for some of the drugs that we use these days, the ACEIs and ARBs, they do a whole lot. You can actually retard progression to end stage for years on end. So those are helping, and so many of the other things we use. So in effect, one thing I keep saying is that we need to get our governments, I've said that to you, Paul, we need to get our governments engaged, governments of the countries in lower and middle income countries. We need to get them engaged. We need to understand that kidney disease is a disease of the poor. And most of these countries, people are poor.
Thank you. Couldn't be clearer, Ifeoma. That's something that the ISN is very keen and already very engaged in doing. Now, we're coming towards the end of the podcast. A couple of points that we absolutely must mention. COVID-19, we couldn't have a discussion about anything in the world today without mentioning COVID-19. Now, Donal, I know that you've given evidence to the UK's House of Lords on this very topic, COVID's impact on kidney disease and the provision of kidney care. Could you please tell us a little bit about what you told the Lords back in September?
Yeah, so the pandemic has been a challenge for all of our communities, some to a greater extent than others. In the UK, we've had fairly high rates of COVID infection. And you know, comparable to the other European countries, and it's been a real strain for for our health system to manage under that pressure of COVID pneumonia and COVID problems. So in the first wave, in the first few months, routine activities, you know, for the health system virtually stopped. So routine activities like identifying kidney disease earlier and monitoring it earlier stopped. Dialysis continued, but transplantation stopped for a time. So that was a major disruption to transplantation and to the usual services. The major issue for people with COVID-19 who get sick and might need to be on an intensive care unit because of their respiratory disease is that they get acute kidney injury. The kidney stops working as well. And in the early months, you know, it was up to, you know, 40-45% of people who had COVID pneumonia requiring ventilation also developed acute kidney injury and needed dialysis or that kind of therapy, kidney therapy. And that the mortality rates in those populations were extremely high. But people then who survive that initial COVID infection, whether in an intensive care unit or not, many of those individuals will have had an episode of reduced kidney function, and not all of those individuals will get recovery back to the baseline of their normal kidney function or what it was before. So there's a tail of problems, you know, from the COVID infection. And we don't know how that will play out. It could be a massive problem, or it could be a moderately big problem. What we do know from other conditions is that around about 10 or 11% of people who have to have dialysis for acute kidney injury on the intensive care unit, around 10 or 12% of those will need to start long-term dialysis or be transplanted, you know, within 5 years. And so that those are potentially big impact from COVID. The second thing to say is that people with kidney disease, particularly those who are on dialysis and transplantation, are at very high risk of dying if they get COVID infection. And people on dialysis, on hemodialysis, come back and forth to the hospital 3 times a week. And so they're very high risk of getting COVID infection. And so we saw very high mortality, probably the highest mortality group of all the populations we saw was in the hemodialysis, the in-center hemodialysis population. So we're now trying to protect those populations and advocating for them to be, you know, early on in the vaccine programs. And the third thing I'll say, which I think is a credit to my surgical colleagues and my colleagues in UK blood and transplant, despite transplant services being stopped nearly everywhere, Belfast continued to transplant. Within days, they moved their transplant service from the hospital, the acute hospital with all the where the infections would go and where there would be risk, they moved it to a cold site which wasn't admitting any infected patients, and they were able to maintain and in fact increase their transplant rates. So it was possible, but in other parts of the United Kingdom, the rates of COVID were higher, and the transplant staff were deployed to the intensive care units and elsewhere. And so it was really to do with a workforce shortage that led to the disruption. But the transplant service has been restored, and they're doing as much as ever. Live donor is not quite where it was at. I think all our clinicians and probably our nurses more than anything else have done a fantastic job in caring for people during this terrible time. It's been a stress for, you know, all of our communities.
Thank you very much. And Ifeoma, how has COVID impacted things in Nigeria?
Yeah, during the heat of it in summer, we had a few cases. We had a number of cases. Initially, the hospitals were filled with people who died within hours of arriving. At that time, we couldn't do the COVID tests all through. But I do want to raise that during this period, we actually lost two prominent nephrologists to COVID-19. 2 months back, we lost Professor Jacob Plongeroux of Ghana to COVID. And then 2 weeks ago, we lost the president of African Society of Nephrology, Professor Anthony Ware, to COVID. So COVID has hit us hard in Africa, African nephrology family.
Thank you very much. And a question to both of you. I think you can answer this between yourselves. In terms of closing message for listeners, what advice would you give them about how to maintain good kidney health?
I would hinge my advice on the 8 golden rules of the World Kidney Day and ISN. It is good to stay hydrated. We've talked about that. Drink a lot of water, especially those in hot areas. Drink not less than 3-4 liters of water per day. That will keep your body clean. Eat healthy. Forget the unhealthy stuff. Eat the healthy stuff. Do not take too much salt. There's no point adding salt on the table. Once your food is served, don't think of adding salt. And avoid, don't eat so much of commercial food. They tend to use a lot of salts. And if you have hypertension, watch your blood pressure. Make sure you take your medications. If you have diabetes, make sure you take your medications and make sure you follow your diabetes diet. And that's also important for every one of us to exercise to keep fit. And then, of course, don't do alcohol so much. I wouldn't do that. And do not smoke. You don't need all that.
Thank you very much. That's absolutely clear. I'm worried about how many of those golden rules I've broken in the last 48 hours. I'm going to go off now and try and implement.
So it's all about, so I would say you kind of pull it together to say, you know, look after your heart, eat for your heart, and get in shape. Shape is a great word because it means a number of things. And, you know, it means, you know, doing exercise and being fit, but it also means, you know, getting rid of the excess baggage there. So if you eat and exercise in the right proportion, you'll look great in Lycra. So that's what you need to do, Paul.
Well, on that note, I'm going to go off and try some Lycra on to see if I look great in it. I won't bother sending you the photographs. But can I just conclude by thanking everybody involved in this, particularly in a fascinating hour and a half. We've covered so much. And I think that the people who've listened to this will now have a really good understanding of what kidney health is, how it operates, and what, most importantly, they can do to maintain the good health of their kidneys. So once again, thanks to you both. And for those of you listening at home or indeed out running and keeping yourselves in shape, if you want to know more about kidney health and what the ISN is doing to improve it, then please do visit our website, www.theisn.org, or follow us on our various social media channels.